Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Another football year has begun. Ahead on Only a Game, an NFL season preview. Also, a soggy U.S. Open gets underway after the rain. A profile of Esther Verguer, winner of 423 straight wheelchair tennis matches since 2003. A former minor league baseball player washes up in my basement. And runners discuss how running helped them cope with the events of September 11, 2001. Also ahead, the citizens of Joplin, Missouri gather at the high school gridiron for the first time since the devastating May 22nd tornado.
They're excited to, you know, have a place to go, because if you come here to the field, you come to the stadium, you don't see any effects of the storm and you don't see the aftermath. And so I think they kind of felt like, hey, you know, got a sense of normalcy.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The only thing we can say for sure about the 2011 NFL season is that the New Orleans Saints will not go undefeated. They lost to the Packers 42-34 on Thursday night. With high hopes and grand possibilities, all the other teams will open tomorrow and on Monday. Joining me now to separate the contenders from the pretenders is Greg Doyle of CBSSports.com. Greg, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. Some say that Thursday night's Packers-Saints game was a preview of the NFC Championship game in January. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely could be. Both teams are going to go to the playoffs for sure. Both teams are going to go deep, I would guess. The only team in their way is the Philadelphia Eagles. Between those three, that's two of them for sure.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Eagles. They extended the contract of quarterback Michael Vick. This contract could go 6 years. It could pay him as much as $100 million. So, who says the correctional system doesn't rehabilitate anybody?
That was the smallest $100 million contract ever. Because, first, the terms of that contract are not sincere. The agent put it out, and it looks good. $100 million is not anywhere close to that. Second, bankruptcy is garnishing almost $20 million of whatever he makes.
Mm-hmm.
Third, his financial people are socking away most of it so he doesn't screw up again. He's living on about $300,000 a year as a stipend. And while that's a lot of money for 99% of us, it's peanuts for a guy who just signed a $100 million contract. Anyway, he keeps calling me for some lunch money.
Does Vic have enough help to get the Eagles back to the Super Bowl for the first time since 2005?
Oh, yes, sir. The Eagles were already so explosive on offense, and they added the Giants' Steve Smith at receiver. They added the Dolphins' Ronnie Brown at running back, and they already had DeSean Jackson, Jeremy Maclin, Brent Seelig, a great tight end, LeSean McCoy running back. Their offense is crazy good. They're loaded. They were called the dream team in tongue-in-cheek for a reason this offseason. They really are loaded.
A quick glance at the CBS Sports NFL power rankings would indicate that the Patriots and the Steelers are the current AFC favorites. That seem about right to you?
You know, we could have been doing this show in 2003 and you would have said the same thing to me. But more than ever, yes, because Peyton Manning is out for an extended period of time, which means no Colts. And the rest of the AFC South is so bad, the Colts might win that division anyway, but they're still not going to be any good. The AFC West is a joke. What does that leave? It leaves the Patriots and Steelers, and it leaves the Ravens and Jets.
On Thursday, we learned that Colts quarterback Peyton Manning had undergone his second neck surgery this year. There's now speculation he might not be back this season. So how do the Colts do without him?
Well, I know I just said that they could win that division because it's really bad. Peyton Manning might win the MVP this year without ever suiting up, because when the Colts go 2-14, we're all going to say, wow, there's nobody more valuable than Peyton Manning.
Many pundits insist that San Diego has what it takes to go all the way this year, but the Chargers always seem to lose their spark early or late or somewhere in between. Why has this talented team been so unsuccessful recently?
Norv and Turner. He was a great assistant coach, is bad to mediocre at best head coach. If he was a sous chef, he'd cut up your carrots into beautiful little pieces. But if he's actually making your entire meal, you ought to politely get up and go to Wendy's.
Now that the lockout is resolved, the season's underway, some time has passed, what would you like to have seen the two sides accomplish that they didn't get done?
I would like to see the retired players get a lot better treatment. They tried to sue to get their way in, and it seemed like, wow, this is going to cause some problems. The retired players are suing to get their way in. This is really going to take a long time. Well, they just kind of got dropped by the wayside, and those guys still don't have the treatment and the pensions and all that they should have. Yeah, they have stuff. They don't have enough stuff because those guys are the walking dead at age 50, and I feel bad for them.
The major post-lockout storyline had to do with the relatively short amount of time players had to learn their playbooks and short-time coaches had to work with them. In general, will we see subpar play during the opening weeks of the season, or maybe some more razzle-dazzle as broken plays don't develop?
Look, Thursday night had two very complex teams playing, complex offenses, the Packers and the Saints, and they combined for almost 1,000 yards of offense and something like 75 points. If we see a better game than that all year, we're in for a treat. It didn't seem to do those teams any harm at all, and the Packers specifically did not get together for off-season unofficial workouts. So the answer to that question, I would say right now, is no, unless we're talking about the Bengals. The Bengals are going to be lousy whether they have a long preseason or not.
I was going to ask about the Bengals next. Their head coach, Marvin Lewis, has insisted that they will improve upon last year's 4-12 record. That doesn't seem too much to shoot for, does it?
That's why Marvin Lewis is so motivational as a coach. Next year, 5-11, baby. Look, Andy Dalton is their rookie quarterback, and he might be good someday in the year 2014, but their receivers are young and not good. The good running back they have is between prison stints, and so is half their defense now that I think about it. Did I mention Ugg with the Bengals?
Tony Romo, the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys, known to some in Texas at least as America's team, missed most of last season with a broken collarbone. The Cowboys wound up 6-10. Romo's healthy now. He's back on the field. Will Dallas fare better this year?
Oh, sure. They'll be the best 6-10 team in football. That's what everybody loves is the Cowboys are great, and we're going to write about the Cowboys until you're sick of reading about them. Even if they are 6-10, we're going to make them sound like the best darn 6-10 team ever. They're the kind of team that Marvin Lewis can aspire to and say, one day, fellas, we're going to be 6-10 also.
All right, Greg, we've talked about some of the premier teams in the league, and we've talked about some of the teams who are going to have a lot of problems. Have you got a kind of tweener in there somewhere, a dark horse that could surprise everybody this season?
Yeah, I'm really bearish or bullish or whatever means good and high on. I'm high on Detroit, as big of a joke as they were under Matt Millen. They've got a former number one draft pick, Matthew Stafford, who's really good and only getting better, young and getting better. Charles Johnson at receiver is incredible. Job at best at running back is healthy. And then they've got the best pair of defensive tackles in Sue and Nick Fairley since the Dallas Cowboys had Randy White and whoever played next to Randy White. So they're going to be really good.
Greg Doyle is a national columnist for CBSSports.com, and he joins Only a Game from time to time to talk pro football. Thanks again, Greg.
Bill, you're welcome.
Tonight's high school football game in Joplin, Missouri will be a big community event, and it will also be a sort of family reunion. The Joplin Eagles will play their first home game since a powerful May 22nd tornado destroyed their high school and much of the town. Only a Game's Greg Eklund was recently in Joplin, and he has this report.
Cleanup continues at what is left of Joplin High School. Twisted metal pierces the classrooms that are visible behind what remains of the brick facade. Papers are still stapled to classroom bulletin boards. Near here, the tornado damaged more than 7,000 homes and 500 businesses. It also took 160 lives and injured more than 900 others. A few blocks to the north is Jung Stadium. Joplin's home field and its surrounding neighborhood with small homes and large trees has a throwback appearance. As head coach Chris Shields describes, it's an old neighborhood with a lot of history, character, and good working class people. Shields says Jung Stadium is a reminder what life was like before May 22nd.
They're excited to, have a place to go. Because if you come here to the field, you come to the stadium, you don't see any effects of the storm, and you don't see the aftermath. And so I think they kind of felt like, hey, got a sense of normalcy.
The first sign of the tornado's effect on the football team was at the Eagles' first practice last month. The number of players was down. Shields, who moved from suburban St. Louis to take over as coach, looked at the roster from the year before. Then he and his assistants worked the phones.
We looked at all the kids that weren't showing up, and we divided up amongst the coaches, and we tried to get in touch with as many of them as possible. We were able to get in touch with most of them. Some of them we weren't, just because all we had through the school was a home phone, and the home was destroyed.
Families of players on the team are among those who have been displaced. On that Sunday afternoon in May, junior offensive lineman Danny Druin attended his girlfriend's high school graduation. The ceremony was a few miles north on the campus of Missouri Southern State University when the tornado ripped through Joplin.
My parents, they live on the other side of town, and I didn't know if they were okay. So it took us like 3 hours to get all the way across town, and we saw a range line, we saw everything, you know. We saw the high school, and it was just, you're just in a state of shock, you know. There was nothing more real than seeing all the damage, you know, directly, you know, right after it happened.
Druin is fortunate. His parents are okay and his house undamaged. But he knows some of his teammates aren't as lucky.
So a lot of people are still transitioning from place to place and shelter to shelter. And you know, so it is scary. Like, well, I wonder where so-and-so is. And you know, you just got to stay positive. And, you know, when you do see those kids, you know, you give them a hug. And, you know, you say that you're sorry for what happened. And, you know, you just got to stick together as a team and be resilient.
I know them all, guys. You keep moving. Go, Christian.
Apart from afternoon practice and the first two games, the only time the entire football team is together is during the morning weight room session. Juniors and seniors attend classes at a vacated retail store in the town's only mall. Freshmen and sophomores are in an old school building near the Central Business District. Athletics Director Jeff Starkweather, who was born and raised in Joplin, looks forward to when everyone is in the same setting for the home opener.
We've moved it from a Friday night to a Saturday night because we want to use it as a celebration, as a thank you to our surrounding communities and those that have helped us as well. So we're expecting a very big crowd. We're expecting a great atmosphere and really looking forward to that game.
And now in the field, ready to perform, is the Joplin freshman dance team under the direction of Abby Ellington.
Abby Ellington, the instructor for the freshman dance squad, owned a dance studio and managed a video store. Both businesses were destroyed by the tornado. Despite her personal travails, Ellington says her team has given her a lift.
They have been the hardest working freshman team I've ever in my life seen. They're troopers. I tell you what, they do a great job. I'm very proud of them.
Though the dance team had a chance to perform on the home field for a JV football game last week, Ellington feels the varsity game will be a major step to getting closer to the regimented schedule they're accustomed to.
I'm big on routines, and my girls are big on routines, so it'll actually help us to get something going soon, so it'll be nice.
The Joplin freshman dance team.
The anticipation of a larger-than-normal crowd is evident. Extra temporary bleachers have been installed behind the north end zone. The Eagles have a 1-1 record going into tonight's game against Springfield Hillcrest. But you get the feeling around here, their record matters less than the simple chance to sit in the home stadium just like before. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. In what had to be one of the tastier assignments available, this week a representative of the Guinness Book of World Records did the certifying necessary to credit the University of Massachusetts with creating the world's largest stir fry. The 4,010-pound meal included 800 pounds of chicken and 500 pounds of onions, among other ingredients. Cooking it required 50 pounds of canola oil. The largest previous stir-fry was a sickly 2,319-pound entry, an effort so pathetic that I won't embarrass the organization that created it by revealing its name.
One time I had all this food and I really, really liked it, so I thought that I would eat some more food.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the most accomplished tennis player of whom you may not ever have heard. But first, I'll discuss some of the tennis players of whom you will have heard, the ones who have survived not only opponents, but the elements at the U.S. Open in New York. The semifinals in the men's and women's tournaments will be contested today and tonight. Joining me now to discuss what's been going on at the Open is John Wertheim of Sports Illustrated. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Before this tournament began, I read a lot about how Serena Williams is still the most fearsome female player on the planet. She will face Caroline Wozniacki, the number one seed, in one of the semifinal matches. Which way is that one likely to go?
I think to the most fearsome player in women's tennis, Serena Williams. It could be a very interesting match. We have a very offensive, aggressive player in Serena against a very defensive player in Wozniacki, who's, of course, ranked number one. Usually we don't pick the number one ranked player to beat number 28, but
right.
I think in this case we're looking at another Serena title here.
The other semifinal features a little less star power. Germany's Angelique Kerber will challenge Samantha Stosur. Did you anticipate that either of these women would get this far?
No star power. I've had about enough of the Angelique Kerber bashing. No, these are two Angelique Kerber, very little known. And Sam Stosur's a nice player, reached the French Open final last year, but it is not at the level of sort of match toughness of Serena. I suspect Stosur will win that, but again, I hate to put it in these terms, but it really is Serena's title to lose.
Roger Federer has reached the Final Four, hardly a new experience for him. He'll face Novak Djokovic, who won his quarterfinal match when his opponent, Janko Tipsurevic, had to withdraw in the fourth set. Given how this tournament has been crunched by rain, does that shortened match give Djokovic perhaps a small advantage today?
Potentially. I mean, it was a fairly long match, and Djokovic had actually lost a set in that match, so his workout wasn't particularly brief. But no, that's a huge element as this tournament progresses with the rain and the cancellations and the delays. Which player gets off the court easiest? Which one can sort of take care of business with the least wear and tear? Which has even a couple extra hours? That could have a huge bearing on the champion.
Yesterday was a mixed day for tennis's Andes. Rafael Nadal beat Andy Roddick, but Andy Murray topped John Isner. Does Murray stand any chance of getting past Rafa to reach the final?
I think he does. I think there's a real opportunity here. Nadal is obviously the defending champion, a terrific player, but really, until he got to these latter rounds, the first week of the tournament, he was not the Rafa Nadal we've come to know and love. And I think he's a little bit banged up. Injuries are always an issue with him, given his aggressive style. I think Andy Murray has a big opportunity here, which would make a lot of British and English tennis fans very happy.
John, with the anniversary of September 11th tomorrow, have you noticed any difference in the security at the tournament there in New York?
Well, it was exceptionally high on Friday, and that's because the First Lady was here, and not having much to do with 9/11. Having tennis played, obviously, on the 10th anniversary, amid this vague threat that we have here in New York, you would think so. But really, it's been interesting. I mean, this has not been a particularly heavy hit theme. And I think some of that is just how global tennis is and the fact that, 10 years have elapsed. I think the organizers anticipated this 10th anniversary would be a bigger deal than it is, frankly.
The attempt to squeeze in matches between storms has had some players complaining about the way this tournament has been run. Are the players just concerned about the possibility of injury on a slick court, or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, I mean, we could do an hour show on this. I mean, I think the U.S. Open doesn't negotiate from a position of strength to start with. There's a sense, particularly among the European players, that it's really all about commerce and tennis gets second shrift. And there is this sense that the players were sort of sent out there under dangerous conditions and that TV interests and ticket interests were being held superior to their health interests. So there was definitely some drama there, and it turned out that the players were actually probably right. It was a very slick court. One of the courts had a bubble. And we'll see where this goes. Was this just sort of angry players frustrated on an off day, or is this the kind of thing that could really sort of galvanize them to form a union, which is actually very much sort of in discussion this week? If any good comes out of this waterlogged second week here, maybe we'll finally get this talk of building a roof, which would obviously have obviated a lot of this. Maybe getting a roof will become a little closer to reality, because the tournament really sort of lost a lot of momentum here when the rains came.
We recently profiled Rohan Bopanna and Isam Qureshi, doubles partners who hail from India and Pakistan, respectively. They failed to reach the men's doubles final, but the team known as the Indo-Pak Express also works to promote peace between their nations. Did they get much reaction from fans in New York?
They really did, which is fortunate. I mean, they had a very successful run here in the past, and I think that helped. doubles as sort of the stepchild of the main draw. You know, Roger Federer is obviously the Serena Williams. Those are obviously the big stars. But the doubles play got some nice publicity, and I think a lot of this driven by Indian and Pakistani communities in New York. Those guys were playing to packed crowds when they took the court. It was nice to see.
All right, the men's final has been pushed to Monday for the second year in a row. Does this end up being bad for tennis?
Oh, I think it is bad for tennis. I mean, if you can get to a TV at 4 o'clock, there's no telling that the local affiliate won't instead decide to show those Gomer Pyle reruns. I mean, it's really, this is not when a prime sporting event. This is the biggest event in the U.S. This is really the show's big stage, and to have an event, you know, Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, Djokovic, have these great players take the court at, 4:30 in the afternoon on a Monday is something decidedly less than ideal.
All right. I've saved my last question about how the Open ends tomorrow and Monday. Give us your picks for women's and men's champs.
I think Serena's the favorite, and she's a good big match player. This is really her occasion. I'll be absolutely astonished if she doesn't win. I think the men, I picked Djokovic before the tournament. He's only lost two matches this year. But, boy, I would not be surprised. Things are breaking awfully well for one Roger Federer. And if he can sort of fire up something for the memory bank, this is a big occasion for him. He now has a day off should he get to the final, which he didn't have in the past. I think things are smelling an awful lot like a nice Roger Federer narrative here.
John Wertheim is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. As part of the magazine's coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, John spoke with members of the 2001 Army and Navy football teams, and you can link to his column about how that day has affected their lives at our website, onlyagame.org. John, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill. Anytime.
Esther Vergeer may be the most dominant athlete on the planet. The 30-year-old Dutch tennis player has won 424 consecutive singles matches over the last 8 years. You're forgiven if you've never heard of her. Wheelchair tennis doesn't command as much media attention as the tennis played by people who aren't in wheelchairs. Only a Game's John Kalish caught up to Vergeer as she breezed through the U.S. Open, and he has this report.
When I first met Esther Vergeer in the lobby of her hotel, I shook her hand and was stunned at how big and strong it was.
Well, yeah, everybody expects like a girl's hand, a lady's hand, but it's strong and it's big and it's not very smooth. But, you know, I use them all day. I work with them all day. And I was 8 years old when I got into a wheelchair. So, you know, all my life I've used them. So, you know, they're my everything.
Those hands weren't always so strong. Vergeer was paralyzed by life-saving surgery when she was 8 years old. She started playing wheelchair tennis when she was 12 and says that initially she was clumsy. She didn't know how to handle her chair. It's hard to believe 18 years later when you watch the 6'2" Dutch athlete propel herself on the court. Vergeer has won 424 consecutive matches since 2003. That's why more than one observer has called her one of the greatest tennis players ever.
She's both long and strong.
Dan James is the coach of the U.S. Paralympic wheelchair tennis team. He's been watching Vergeer since she was a teenager.
Her arms are long. She has long levers to strike the ball, which is a physical advantage, but she's also physically strong, so her pushing, her maneuvering is incredibly fast and graceful. And so when you watch her play, you hardly even notice the wheelchair because she's so smooth as she moves around the court. Imagine having to do all your movement with your racket hand and not being able to take the racket back until right before the ball is there. And that's the challenge that they face.
The chairs used in wheelchair tennis are different from their civilian counterparts. The two large wheels are angled towards the ground, and there are three rollerblade wheels, two in the front and one in the back. The only difference between wheelchair tennis and the conventional form is that players are allowed to hit the ball after it has bounced twice.
40-15.
In her first U.S. Open match, Vergeer handily disposed of Marjolein Baus, also of the Netherlands, 6-1, 6-0. Vergeer says the ability to stay calm and focused during matches can be the difference between winning and losing.
In tough situations, if you can get calm, it'll help you get through. And I know that I am able to beat anybody I know that I can do it. I don't know if it's going to happen, but I know that I can do it. And you know, believing in myself and believing that on the court is really giving me such a, you know, big confidence that even when I'm down, I know that there will be a turning point and I can take over again.
I have watched her down 5-2 in a set and get this look in her eye and win the next five games to win the set 7-5.
Again, U.S. wheelchair tennis coach Dan James.
I have watched her down match points at the Beijing Paralympic final and win that match. She is the most mentally tough athlete I have ever seen.
In 2009, Vergeer left her coach of 10 years and started training with Sven Groeneveld, a Dutchman who's worked with some of the top able-bodied players, including Roger Federer, Monica Seles, and Caroline Wozniacki. Groeneveld had never coached a wheelchair player, but he agreed to become Vergeer's coach on the spot. He tries to get together with her when he's in Holland or when they're at the same tournaments. Groeneveld was on hand at the U.S. Open earlier this week to watch Vergeer's first match.
She's renowned for her backhand. She has an extremely powerful backhand where she can really take the players out of the court, and that then exposes the weakness of her opponents. And then she can finish with her forehand. So she sets herself up well. She really makes her opponent play a lot of balls at the same time with a lot of pressure.
The last opponent to beat Vergeer was Australian Daniela Di Toro, who did it in 2003 in Sydney.
You know those days where you wake up and you're like, it's a good day. It was a good day. The conditions were pretty challenging. I think I dealt with them a lot better than she did and just did it quickly, really.
Di Toro left tennis in 2004 and became a certified practitioner of Chinese medicine. She's returned to the game but has lost to Vergeer 10 times in the last few years. Still, Di Toro holds her Dutch rival in high regard.
She's that one person that took wheelchair tennis to a whole new level. She's a bit like Martina Navratilova in that sense, you know. She also is one of the first to have a professional career as a wheelchair tennis player.
Five out of the world's top six female players are from the Netherlands. One possible explanation is that tennis is the second most popular sport in Holland. Another is that the Dutch government provides all disabled people who want one with a sports wheelchair every 5 years. Marjolein Baus is a 23-year-old Dutch player who is ranked fifth in the world. She had the misfortune of being paired with Vergeer in the first round of the U.S. Open this week.
Holland is a small country, so it's possible for all wheelchair tennis players to come together to train, to practice at the same location and learn from each other. A lot of players gave up their jobs or stopped with their studies to really live for the sport and to improve their game, and that's what some other players maybe should do to get in the top six.
It looks like Esther Vergeer might hold on to her position as the top-ranked women's wheelchair tennis player in the world. She'll compete against Annick van Koot, also of the Netherlands, in the finals on Sunday. Vergeer says that in the last couple of years, she's managed to stop obsessing about her winning streak, which is now 8 years old.
I was more afraid of losing than I was eager to win. I realized that that shouldn't be the case. So I set myself some other goals, and I'm trying not to worry, not to think about the winning streak anymore.
One of the goals Vergeer has set for herself off the court is a career in sports marketing. She also has her own foundation and conducts 90 sports clinics a year for disabled kids in Holland. Before she retires from competitive tennis, Vergeer will again go for the gold in the 2012 Paralympics in London. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
You're listening to Only a Game. My basement is full of photographs of ballparks and baseball players. A couple of weeks ago, it was also full of water. Carlos Pena, one of the guys working for the company that helped us clean up after Hurricane Irene's departure, was not surprised to see the water. He was thrilled to see the baseball stuff. Though he never made the bigs, Carlos Pena told me he'd played minor league ball for a team in the Cleveland Indians organization over 20 years ago. I asked him if he'd quit baseball or if baseball had quit him. He smiled and shook his head.
No, well, even now, I was doing pretty good. I was hitting 345 a year. And after the summer finished, I go back to the Dominican Republic. And then a motorcycle accident break my spine. I was in a wheelchair for 4 years. It was unbelievable.
Carlos Pena tried coming back after he'd recovered. Didn't work out. But that disappointment didn't diminish his enthusiasm for baseball, perhaps because the game was part of his family's history. At the foot of my basement stairs, there's a framed magazine cover featuring my favorite ball player on the day he retired. Though that happened before Carlos was born, he knew about the man in the photo, courtesy of his father.
And my father's an all-time baseball player.
So I understand, and you went around the corner here and saw a couple of the pictures that I have of Willie Mays, and that sparked some memories.
Yeah, my father faced Willie Mays, I think in the 70s, 60s. They traveled a team to the Dominican Republic with Juan Marichal, and my father was telling me a story about him facing then.
But I got to ask you the key question for somebody whose father pitched against Willie Mays. Did your father tell you how he did against Willie Mays?
My father said he struck him out once. And Willie may hit a home run the next one back.
The family connections to baseball now and then don't end there. Tony Pena, late a catcher with the Red Sox, among other teams, now a coach with the Yankees, is Carlos Pena's cousin. Carlos himself coaches in the Framingham, Massachusetts Little League. A couple of times a year, he takes groups of young players from the U.S. to the Dominican Republic and Haiti, where he distributes as many baseballs, bats, and gloves as he can collect from donors.
It's unbelievable how the kids playing baseball in there. Still today, you see kids in my country playing with water cap.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable.
Bottle cap.
Bottle cap.
Hit, try and hit with a broomstick.
Yeah, with a broomstick. It's fun. You know, kids learn.
Kids learn with the help of guys like Carlos Pena, whom I'd probably never have met if the basement I'd filled up with baseball photographs hadn't filled up with water. So, hey, Irene, good riddance, but thanks for that. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world. extension.harvard.edu. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Jesus Villanueva of Moxie, Washington, learned to throw a rope in Jalisco, Mexico 30 years ago. He hadn't lassoed anything since then until last Wednesday when he heard Noya Dietz screaming that her dogs had been washed away in the flooded Rosa Irrigation Canal near which Villanueva was working. The concrete sides of the canal were too steep for the dogs, Fawn and Nia, to climb. They were in danger of drowning. Enter Villanueva with his rope. He lassoed each dog and pulled them both to safety. I was amazed, the grateful Ms. Dietz said. He just kind of came out of nowhere. There is no truth to the rumor that she next said, who was that masked man, since Jesus Villanueva was not wearing a mask.
Look, die-i-oh, get along, little dog, is it your misfortune and none of my own?
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, gathering runners' remembrances of 9/11. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The NFL season began on Thursday evening when the Green Bay Packers beat the New Orleans Saints 42-34. You agree with those who say the Pack improved during the lockout?
I don't know if they improved during the lockout, but they certainly had less of a changeover between last season and this season than most Super Bowl champions do, and they certainly looked like they hadn't lost a step.
Tomorrow, Colts quarterback Peyton Manning's streak of 227 consecutive starts will end. Manning had neck surgery on Thursday. It was his third procedure in 19 months, and, of course, there's speculation that he won't be back at all this year. Will the Colts and the publicists of the National Football League survive?
I don't think the Colts will survive as a legitimate championship contender, that's for certain. Apparently, the most optimistic scenario has him coming back in 8 weeks, which by that time the Colts may well be out of contention anyway. And if that's the case, I don't know why they wouldn't put him on injured reserve and keep him out for the rest of the year.
Chicago Bears linebacker Lance Briggs says he's ready to take a fine this weekend as he plans to intentionally and publicly break the NFL uniform code. But the league informed equipment managers on Friday morning that non-standard gloves and shoes are being allowed this week. What's going on here? Has the NFL finally stopped being so stuffy about uniforms?
Yeah, Lance Briggs is going to wear American flag gloves and shoes in remembrance of the 9/11 attacks. And the league, I think, has come to its senses in a big way and decided not to fine him over it.
I have to admit, Charlie, I do not fully understand the brouhaha going on between Baylor and Texas A&M right now. I know it involves the Aggies' desire to move to the SEC. There are potential lawsuits in the offing. Can you help me with this?
Yeah, basically college sports is resolving itself into about two major conferences. As you said, Texas A&M wants to go to the SEC. The problem is, now you have to stay with me on this, all nine remaining members of the Big 12 have to agree not to sue the SEC and Texas A&M if they do that, and Baylor will not waive its right to do that.
That's so.
So in that case, Baylor is sort of hanging things up, trying to force a decision, oddly enough, on Oklahoma, which wants to move to the Pacific 12 Conference.
College football's other big story seems to be the new uniforms on the players at the University of Maryland. These uniforms feature, among other things, the colorful checks also featured on the Maryland state flag. I'm not an expert in fashion regarding uniforms or anything else, but are they all that bad?
Well, they're a little bit strange. And as you know, the Maryland state flag is the oddest state flag we have.
It is a very peculiar
flag. It looks
flag.
Like you would wave it to end or begin an automobile race.
Yes, exactly.
But apparently the other thing similarity was noticed, the Charm City Roller Girls, the roller derby team, are wearing practically the same helmets as the Terps are.
And they got there first.
Exactly.
Houston Astros owner Drayton McClain wants to sell the team. Businessman Jim Crane wants to buy the team. The two men signed a sale contract in May. What's holding things up?
Well, it depends who you talk to. If you talk to Jim Crane, he believes that the approval is being held up because Major League Baseball wants the Astros to move to the American League. But there's also some problems with his previous business, which is an air freight company, involving discrimination, which is bad enough, and war profiteering, which is even worse. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at him, too.
The schedule for the U.S. Open tennis tournament has been redrawn after rain washed out Tuesday's play and then all but 15 minutes on Wednesday. The men's final will now be held on Monday for the second consecutive year. Apparently, the time off has given some of the players the opportunity to voice other objections. What's going on?
Yeah, the U.S. Open, unlike all major tournaments, runs the men's semifinals and finals back-to-back Saturday, Sunday, although they haven't been doing it recently because it's been raining on them every year at the final weekend of the tournament. This is not something that the upper-level players who are likely to be playing in the semifinals and finals appear to like. They're even talking about forming a union, so who the heck knows where this may end up.
After all that bluster, there are signs of progress in the negotiations between the NBA and the players' union. Are you among those who find this week's developments encouraging?
Well, they're talking, which is the important thing. I'm starting to hear now that maybe the worst-case scenario is a 50-game season. I mean, this has been the most hopeful week they've had since this thing started. You know, this can only be good.
Mr. NASCAR?
Yes.
Put your NASCAR hat on here. Apparently, there are 14 drivers gunning for 10 spots in NASCAR's Chase for the Cup during tonight's Race at Richmond. I probably should have said Race at Richmond. Will you be tuning into that race? The sporting news suggests it's going to be a bloodbath.
Yeah, suggesting that the only way they can handle Brad Keselowski is to wreck him.
Hmm.
And as the sporting news said, that may seem stark and unsportsmanlike. You think?
The Rugby World Cup is underway in New Zealand. Charlie,
I love it.
And if you don't
hold on one second.
Oh, it's the haka. Yes, the haka
there
dance.
Go.
There it is.
We do the haka for the Rugby World
That's
Cup.
Excellent. And you got to say something more about it because otherwise some listener will complain that we've ignored the event entirely. So something, please.
No, I think, you know, it became a major event with the release of the movie Invictus a couple of years ago. People know what the Rugby World Cup is. New Zealand has opened its World Cup play, romping over Tonga, not to be confused with Tsonga, who lost in the semifinals of the U.S. Open, by the way. The New Zealand people seem to think that their performance, while handily defeating Tonga, was a little spotty, and the All Blacks are looking to be a little bit better next time around.
And finally, Filippo Mangini, the captain of the Italian national swimming team.
Known to his friends, by the way, as Super Pippo.
Is that right?
That's what it says right here.
Yeah,
nicknamed Super Pitbull.
But not so much anymore because he lost a race on Thursday, even though his opponents had to swim twice as far as he did.
And one of them was only 9 years old.
Well, we're wondering whether this fellow known as Super Pippo has suddenly gotten off to a very slow start.
He lost to two dolphins, one named King, who was 19, and one named Leah, which is a really boring dolphin name, by the way, who's only 9. I mean, Leah's obviously born in the suburbs.
Prodigy.
Rides the family minivan to soccer practice.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, they had a specially arranged event in a swimming pool in Italy, and they had to swim about twice as many lengths as he did, but they did overtake him in the last few yards. Super Pitbull seems to have taken very well. He says he's a little bit in love with Dolphin Leah, but she's only 9 and their family's objected.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books. He joins me each week on Only a Game at this time as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
They call him Flipper, faster than lightning. No one you see is smarter than he. And we know Flipper lives in a world full of wonder, flying there under the sea.
A recent email from Adrian Oliver Alarcón reads, here in Mexico, baseball is very popular and the Quintana Roo Tigers are the champions of 2011. Please send me a salute on your program. I hear it every week. Accordingly, I salute you, Adrian, and your Tigers as well. Felicidades. My conversation last week with Scott Cassiola about his Wall Street Journal story concerning remarkable running streaks provoked an email from Larry Campbell. He alerted me to a streak described in a book titled The Reading Promise by Alice Osma. When Ms. Osma was in the fourth grade, she and her father began a streak of nights during which he read to her, and that streak did not end until Ms. Osma left home for college. Daniel Grant, who hears the program on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, had a problem with last week's program. I tuned in to hear some late results and analysis of the U.S. Open, he wrote. Not a word about our country's most important tennis event. Perhaps you believe your audience is only interested in jock sports and buffoonery. On our Facebook page, Leora Dowling suggested that she'd have enjoyed hearing about the Open, too. Daniel, Leora, I hope you enjoyed this week's Open coverage. Last week, Charlie and I discussed a sports-related project in the Netherlands, the construction of a mountain, which would require some 40 years. Charlie made fun of me when I compared the feat to the building of Gaudi's Sagrada Familia Cathedral, in progress since the late 1800s in Barcelona, but the reference brought a smile to Malvina Abbott, who hears the program on KPBS in San Diego. I was one of the 13 people who got the joke about Sagrada Familia. She wrote, keep the jokes coming. First-time listener Katie Osweiler got the reference, too, and she told us that via the Facebook page. 2 weeks ago, in our best-of edition of Only a Game, we reprised my conversation with comic hero creator extraordinaire Stan Lee, who has also invented heroes for various NHL teams. Mr. Lee's efforts provoked Dave Pearson, who wrote that somewhere he has an X-Men number one, to submit this haiku. Incredible Hulk Hockey bought the comic for the fight and a game broke out. And then, perhaps realizing he'd included an extra syllable, he tried again and wrote, Bruce Banner on ice, padded, bladed, stick in hand, wears the Stan Lee cup. Great stuff. Will this be the start of something big? Let us know via the website onlyagame.org, or you can leave a message on the listener line, 617-353-1860. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Tomorrow will mark the 10th anniversary of the hijacking of four airplanes, two of which brought down the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York. Remembrances of that day have filled the news for the past week. The current issue of Runner's World features several articles in which runners discuss their experiences related directly or indirectly to the events of September 11th, 2001. Joining me now is executive editor Charlie Butler. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
And we're also joined by Anne Summerlath-Pizzi, one of the runners who told her story in Runner's World. Anne, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Charlie, why don't you start by explaining how you decided to include this feature in the magazine?
We knew there was going to be a lot of coverage about 9/11 with the 10th anniversary, but we also knew that running is a sport that people participate to kind of get away from tragedies and have their thoughts, and we just know a lot of runners who were affected by 9/11.
And you witnessed the destruction of the World Trade Center from the window of your apartment, the apartment in which you were living 10 years ago. How close were you to the towers?
I was about 250 yards away.
Oof.
A little too close for comfort.
Yeah, a lot too close for comfort. At what point did it occur to you that was really too close for comfort and you better get out of there?
You know, to be honest, I at first didn't want to go. People were evacuating our building all around me, and as everyone has heard, there were conflicting directives that day, and so I decided to stay, and then it became a matter of sort of staying somewhere where I felt comfortable while there was all this turmoil around me, and it was at the point that the first tower came down that I decided it was definitely time to get out.
When you realized that it was time to get out, you packed sneakers and running clothes. Do you remember making that decision?
I don't. It was, I guess what I remember about it is how instinctive it was. I literally did not think a thought of bringing anything beyond running clothes or enough to get me through the next 24 hours. But, you know, honestly, it's the fact that I had those with me that sort of helped me start kind of getting past it and almost healing a little bit from the very next day.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you were thinking about when you got up on September 12th and realized, yeah, I'm going to run today?
You know, I think I was still, to be perfectly honest, in some sort of a state of shock. It was almost instinctive for me to just get up and put on those running clothes and get out the door and start doing something to kind of get back to some sense of normalcy. I mean, I was no longer in my apartment. I didn't have family near me. But running was just something that, you know, I had gotten to the point in my life for the prior 10 years that I did every morning, and that was just the way to keep life moving on.
Runners are fiercely protective of their running time often. Charlie, do you think sticking to a routine, in this case the routine of running a mile, 3 miles, whatever it might be each day, no matter what the circumstances, is a way for people to assert themselves against the kind of madness and despair associated with 9/11 and other catastrophes?
Well, I think running does just allow you those moments where you have 15 or 20 minutes or, you know, for some people an hour to get out there, in a way relax, not think about what may have happened or think deeply about what happened, because you have those moments of solitude. You know, we've gone through a pretty tough time in this country, and I can only presume that people who, like Ann, who had to get out on September 12th, had to get away from watching TV and hearing all the reports and clearing their heads and saying, this will never be normal again, but I got to attempt to get there.
Charlie hit on something that I think really was important to me, was the running is a very solitary endeavor. And this, you know, on those days following September 11th, that allowed me to clear my mind while at the same time sort of focus and think about what I'd been through without TV and other people and, you know, everything else around me. It just really allowed me to kind of focus inwardly on what I'd witnessed.
Charlie, you, like a lot of editors, producers, TV station managers, and others, have chosen to focus attention on the 10th anniversary of the destruction of the World Trade Center. What do you hope the stories in Runner's World and perhaps throughout the media will accomplish?
Once this story was published, it was amazing how many stories came back through email and other forms that said, I so feel what those other people are going through. And I guess the hope is that it will help people. And maybe by looking at the past, it makes your present feel just a little bit better.
Among those stories that the issue generated, or perhaps among the stories in the issue itself, were there particular ones that surprised and moved you?
Well, the story by Ann obviously was a touching one. There was also one by a woman named Liz Best, whose husband, Jeremy Glick, was on the airplane that ended up crashing in western Pennsylvania. And she writes of how she still obviously remembers her husband, but she's also taken up running to the point where she's going to run the New York City Marathon this November with a number of other survivors whose friends and family died on that plane. And I think that just touched the chord of how close this sport and this tragedy are connected, that you know, a man died that day, and yet his widow is so connected to the sport, something that they did together, that she's now going to run 26.2 miles in his memory and the memories of other people on that plane. That story really hit home for a lot of people.
Charlie Butler is the executive editor of Runner's World. Charlie, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
And Ann Summerlath Pizzi is one of the runners who contributed her story to the magazine's collection of 9/11-related stories. Ann, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me on.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Maria Carter at KCUR in Kansas City. Our intern is Jillian Geib. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Greg Eklund's photos of Joplin, Missouri, or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Joplin High School football coach Chris Shields, who observes that his players have yet to replace the wardrobes they lost in the May 22nd tornado.
They don't have slacks. They don't have dress clothes yet. And so we told them just, you know, wear whatever they had. And so that was fine.
I like it. Come as you are football. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.